are listening to the Stillbirth Matters podcast, presented by the Star Legacy Foundation, a national nonprofit founded on the belief that every pregnancy deserves a happy ending. Learn more at starlegacyfoundation.org. Our guest for this episode is Kathleen Massman, a licensed professional clinical counselor, owner of Healing Moments Counseling in Minnesota, and facilitator of an infant and pregnancy loss support group. Kathleen's decision to become a specialist in grief and loss was driven by the loss of her son in 2011. She specializes in grief and trauma work, with a specific interest in her work with bereaved parents and siblings. Well, Kathleen, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today.
It's great to be here with you.
My first question for you before we get into your professional journey is to talk a little bit about your personal journey, because that's what led you to where you are today. Can you take us back to 2011, kind of just what happened with your loss, and then the steps after that that helped lead you to where you are today professionally?
Sure. So in 2010 and 2011, I was pregnant with our second son, Jacob, and quite unexpectedly, in the middle of January, he was born a few weeks early at 33 weeks gestation, and he passed away from an unknown heart defect or lung defect. We're still not quite sure what happened to him. But really, his loss and going through the grief associated with his loss really catapulted me into a different direction professionally. Prior to becoming pregnant with him and losing him, I worked as a therapist for several years before that. Loved working with grief, used to tell people grief was something that I was very interested in, but really losing Jacob changed the way I looked at grief forever. And almost in one instant, I felt like everything I knew about grief and everything I had tried teaching people about grief was not exactly what it was. And so in the months after we lost our son, I really did everything they tell you not to do when you're going through an important loss. They say don't make big decisions. We decided that I was going to quit my current position working down in the cities, and I was going to open up my own practice up in the Monticello area. And really doing that was my way of grieving. It was what I did with that grief in a tangible sort of way.
What were you doing in the Twin Cities as your career, and what exactly did you transition to?
Sure. So in the Twin Cities, I was working in a private practice, working mostly with adults and teenagers, sort of depression, anxiety work, general therapy work. And then when I moved up to Monticello, my intent was to have the private practice, but really to continue being a generalist, to continue working with depression, anxiety, teen-related issues. And as sort of fate would have it, my first client that called and asked for an appointment had just lost her daughter 2 months before she called to make the appointment. And so I took the appointment a little hesitantly because I was fairly fresh off of losing our son, and found just such incredible deep meaning working with the lost community. And that really just propelled me into wanting to become better at grief work and becoming more immersed in that field in general.
So you mentioned that people like us who have lost children are told not to make gigantic life decisions in the weeks and months following a loss. You did not do that. Do you regret making that major life change?
I don't. I don't necessarily recommend that everyone do that, but it was very consistent with my personality doing something like that. And I think that's one of the important things about looking at grief and expressions of grief is what works for you as an individual. What worked for me might not be a great solution for anyone else when they're in those initial months of grieving, but it definitely worked for me and for our family.
We get a lot of questions from families who have recently experienced the loss of a baby, wondering if what they're experiencing is quote-unquote normal. In particular, many are concerned about depression, and I think a lot of people don't understand the differences between grief and depression. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Of course. Some of the confusion between grief and depression really comes from how similar those outward symptoms can look between the two. So one of the first things that I think is really important when it comes to grief is to acknowledge that grief isn't a disease. It isn't a mental health diagnosis. It gets confused with depression because it is so similar, but it really is a very different thing. all my clients are pretty familiar with hearing me say that grief is just love. And because we love deeply, we grieve deeply. Grief is natural, it's normal, and it's expected. We expect that when people lose something important to them, a person, a place, a thing, that they're going to have a reaction to that. For me, one of the best ways that I can think about the difference between grief and depression is by looking at the definitions of the two. So the definition of grief is just an unexpected reaction to the loss of a loved person, place, or thing, a deep sorrow caused by death or change. The important part of that is it is a reaction. And that's really the major difference between grief and depression. Depression is not a reaction to something that happens. It's not a reaction to a situation. And so with depression, we can see the sort of confusion between symptoms, difficulty sleeping, difficulty eating, sort of a withdrawal from social situations, a withdrawal from activities that are normally something that person would enjoy. But again, that real difference between the catalyst, what brought on those symptoms. And in the case of grief, it's the loss of something or someone.
So how do we explain the similarities between the two concepts of grief and depression? And can grief lead to depression if it's not properly managed?
Sure. So some of the similarities you're going to see between grief and depression that do aid in sort of that confusion will be those outward symptoms. So some of those outward symptoms that are going to cross the boundary between the two of them will be mood swings, tearfulness, difficulty maintaining connections with family or friends, perhaps difficulty returning to work after a significant loss. But some of the things that we're going to see are different is really the way depression and grief progress. So with grief, symptoms tend to change over time. They don't go away, they just change. Most parents in particular who talk about their experience with grief will talk about it as if it comes in waves. Those waves can be triggered by events, sensations, thoughts, or particular situations that are familiar to the loss. Depression doesn't act that way. Depression tends to be more persistent and more pervasive in nature. So we tend to see it sort of continue along a continuous line without those waves that we see with grief.
I know from hosting this podcast that our listeners like it when they can get tips from the people we interview. So what recommendations would you have for a parent who is both grieving and depressed?
So lots of different tips or just suggestions that I would have for parents who are grieving and worried about the possibility of becoming depressed. And one of those things would be really finding someone that they can talk through their feelings with. Most parents who are going down that road of grief, losing a child, know that it can be a long road, that it can be a lonely road. And the advice I would really give is it doesn't have to be a lonely road. There are so many support systems out there, and I would really encourage them to reach out to those support systems, whether there is a concern for depression or there isn't a concern for depression. And those support people can be professional or personal in nature, finding family members, friends who are willing to sit with them through that grief and really be present in it. Time after time, that's what we hear from parents, is they just want someone to be present in that grief with them, someone who doesn't rush them along, someone who doesn't make them feel like they need to get better, someone who's just willing to continue to be there day after day, week after week, year after year. I also recommend if there's a concern about depression, seeking out professional help if that's of interest. And that could be from a pastor if there's a religious component for the family or from a counselor. The big recommendation I make when it comes to seeking out counseling is to find someone who really specializes in grief work. All the time in this field, and I was a person who did this myself, all the time you ask someone in this field if they do grief work and the answer is almost unanimously yes. The fact that you can do grief work and maybe have done grief work in the past does not mean that you specialize in grief work. And I think that's a really important component when it comes to working in particular with parents who have experienced a loss of pregnancy, an infant, or a child.
When my wife and I experienced the loss of our daughter, I remember hearing from many people the advice of you need to take care of yourself in these times following a traumatic life event. Because if you don't take care of yourself now, it may come out in counterproductive ways later on. And that always scared me. And I was still, to this day, I'm still cognizant of, have I taken care of myself enough? Did I take care of myself enough? And always being completely mindful of that advice that so many people gave me. And I think a question a lot of people have that I speak to who experience loss is, how do we know if we're properly taking care of ourselves? And maybe it's a different answer for everybody, but what types of signs do you look for to make sure that, that people are practicing that self-care that so many people preach about these days?
So I think self-care is incredibly important when we're talking about grief. One of the things that probably is important to sort of talk about in terms of my perspective on grief is, as a society, we look at grief as having a starting point, a definitive starting point, which it does, but we also want it to have an ending point. We want to get through the stages of grief, and we want to get to acceptance, and we want to move on. And that's really what society wants us to do. They want us to go through the stages and accept what's happened and move on. They don't want to be reminded that a baby was lost. They don't want to be reminded that a child died. Those are really unpleasant conversations from a societal perspective. The difference for me is I don't believe there is an ending point to grief. I don't believe there's some finish line that we get to where we're rewarded with acceptance and we move on with our life and forget what's happened. I think that grief is a journey that we continue to take every single day of the rest of our lives, and that does mean taking care of ourselves. Part of taking care of ourselves has to be continuing to give ourselves time and space to grieve. I attended an amazing certification training down in Arizona with Joanne Cacciatore on traumatic bereavement. And one of the things she talks a lot about is the fact that as practitioners, we cannot hope to take people to the places that we're not willing to go ourselves. And I think that's important for practitioners, but I think that's important for each of us to remember in our own journey of grief, is we have to be willing to go there. We have to be willing to sit with our own grief and process the things that come up and allow ourselves the space and time to do that. And how we do that might be very different. We talk a lot about gender differences and how men and women will grieve differently and how they will take care of themselves differently. And that's all true. And so for me, it's not so much about what you're doing. It's that you're making time and the space to be doing it, and that you're doing it in a way that is healthy for you.
You talked a lot about society and what society expects out of people who experience a traumatic event. One of the things I hear from people who experience loss is that following the loss of a child or a traumatic event, many people in their world treat them with extreme kindness and care and compassion for a couple of months or a few weeks or whatever that period of time is, but then they do expect there to be an end point on the grief. Do you find that once that timeline has passed and society expects people to get back to normal, quote-unquote, that can exacerbate someone's situation, exacerbate their grief?
We do find that. We do find that for the most part, people report that for the first 6 to 12 months, there's a fair amount of compassion coming their way. There's a fair amount of presence in their life, people wanting to be caretaking of them, people wanting to sit with them in that grief. But really after that 1 year mark, we find that people stop having that support. And really the need to have someone there with them hasn't changed very much. They still need those people to be there. And so we see what starts out as a very large group of support really shrinking down. And I think for the lucky few, those people still have a few core people within their lives, family members, friends, professionals, that are willing to be there for them. We certainly found that to be true in our life. We had an amazing support system for the first year, family, friends, colleagues of mine, colleagues of my husband, who were willing to be there and be really present. And it really was as if after a year, many of them said, well, you've had a year, we've been there, you've grieved. We found ourselves pregnant 8 weeks after we lost our son, and so there was also sort of the duality of, well, you've had another child now, so it's really time for you to move on. And so when you're faced with that, I think a lot of families have to figure out, what do I do for support now? Now that sort of everyone that was here is no longer, where do I find those support options? And I think that's where group support comes in, finding women, families, couples who have gone through similar situations are really important connections for people to make. And luckily, I think that now
is sort of, we have an advantage of having those groups out there in more abundance than 20 or 30 years ago.
Let's shift gears and talk about postpartum depression. Does postpartum depression look differently than other forms of depression?
It's a great question. So I'm going to split up postpartum depression into three categories. One is baby blues, then postpartum depression or mood and anxiety disorders, and the third is postpartum psychosis. So if we think about postpartum baby blues, we're really talking about sort of that irritability, anxiety, fluctuating mood, and sort of emotional reactivity within the first few weeks after baby is born. And really that's affecting 60 to 85% of women. So it is not at all abnormal for a woman to be experiencing the baby blues. The key with the baby blues is really those symptoms should resolve within a few weeks. So she shouldn't be experiencing those fluctuating moods, the anxiety, the irritability nearly as much. If we start to look 2 weeks past the baby's birth, then we start talking about postpartum depression or postpartum anxiety. And that's really affecting 20 to 25% of women on a regular basis. The key to seeing the difference between that and baby blues is that the symptoms are moderate to severe, and they can last for up to a year. Postpartum depression or postpartum anxiety can be considered an active diagnosis for a full year after baby's born. Some of the differences in symptoms might be excessive guilt, anxiety, depressed mood, fatigue, hypersomnia. One of the things that makes it difficult to identify postpartum depression is the fact that every parent knows when you bring home a newborn, you're not sleeping well to begin with. And so that fatigue piece can really be missing if you brought baby home. Postpartum psychosis affects a very small number of women, but it is always a psychiatric emergency and almost always requires hospitalization. And when we talk about psychosis, we're talking about rapid cycling of emotions, agitation, hallucinations, delusions, cognitive impairment, and low insight. So it's all on a continuum, and it's really just a matter of where the severity and the persistence of symptoms will lie. You asked about the difference between postpartum and just major depression, and it really is the time frame of birth. If birth is within a year of the onset of symptoms, we tend to consider it postpartum depression or postpartum anxiety. As a rule, postpartum depression and anxiety will set in within days or weeks of birth. One of the important things to note in terms of risk factors is that if a mother has experienced the loss of a pregnancy or an infant, they are always at increased risk for a postpartum mood or anxiety disorder. And that doesn't matter which pregnancy it is after the loss. They're always at increased risk. And it's also important to remember that dads can suffer from postpartum depression as well. Reasons behind it may be very different, but it's a huge change for dads as well that they're going through, bringing baby home or maybe having a baby after a loss before then.
We talked earlier about people who have experienced the loss of a child. What advice would you have for them, or what tips do you have for them? Let's talk about just friends and family members. How would they know if their loved one or someone they care about is depressed or experiencing normal grief? When does it rise to the level of becoming a concern and when they should say something?
Sure. So a lot of times what gets thrown around is normal grief versus abnormal grief, or productive grief versus unproductive grief. I tend not to use any of those phrases in my practice because I don't think there are a whole lot of behaviors that fall into abnormal grief, but there are some things we should be looking out for. And a few of those would include suicidal thoughts, gestures, or behaviors, as well as a report of delusions or hallucinations. Some of the things we have to be careful of when we talk about suicidal behavior, suicidal sort of verbiage, is that it isn't uncommon for parents to talk about wanting to be with their child, or just the bereaved talking about wanting to be with their loved one. It's pretty common language for people to use, and it really shouldn't be interpreted as suicidal intent, but should be evaluated carefully and compassionately to make sure that there isn't anything behind it that might indicate more of a depressive state or more of a concern about safety. With hallucinations and delusions, it's really the same thing in the sense of parents in particular will at times talk about vivid dreams involving their child that has passed away, will at times talk about hearing a baby crying or seeing a baby. Again, we want to make sure we evaluate those compassionately so that we can find more support or additional help for them if necessary, but we don't necessarily want to assume that they've fallen into a deep depressive state or any sort of psychosis, because it may be that they're just so intently missing that person that they have those memories or they have those sounds and visual effects.
Final question for you, because you have experienced your own loss of a child and because you work in the field that you work in, we're finding more and more that when a parent loses a child and they're in the hospital and maybe they're laying down at night that night trying to make sense of what happens, sometimes they didn't even know stillbirth existed, or they didn't even know what perinatal loss is, or whatever their loss was. So they get on the phone and they start Googling and trying to find whatever information they can find. Sometimes they land on the Star Legacy Foundation website. Sometimes they start listening to our podcast. So I wanted to give you the opportunity to send a message or anything you wanted to say to anyone who may be sitting in the hospital right now and just experienced the worst trauma that a human can go through. What do you want them to know as it relates to what you do for a living? What do you want them to hear?
I think that's a great question. I think what I want them to hear most clearly is that they aren't alone. One of the most profound feelings after a loss can be this deeply rooted feeling of loneliness, that there's no one else in the world that can possibly understand the pain that you're in and the experience you've just gone through. And while there is no single person in the world that can tell you exactly how you're feeling and exactly what you've experienced, there is a community of professionals as well as lay people who are there for you, who will sit next to you during this journey and really will be your companion on it. You don't have to do it alone. You can find those resources. And if you don't feel like you're in a place to seek out those resources, there are people, professionals, who will help you find those so that you don't have to actively be looking for those.
Well, thank you so much for your time and for sharing your insights on our podcast. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's all for this episode of the Stillbirth Matters podcast, presented by the Star Legacy Foundation. I'm Chris Duffy. Thanks for listening.